Happy Father's Day today. In our day and age of fatherhood, it seems like fatherhood sort of come under a little bit of attack. That if you're a good dad and you want to stand up for being a good dad, that's not so popular these days. Also, it's interesting because whether we want to admit it in our culture or not, God created men and women differently. I don't know if y'all noticed that already. You know, but he did, and not just physically, but he also created us psychologically, emotionally, in many ways differently, and I think that God designed that for a reason, because it takes a dad and a mom to raise great kids. Now, my hat is off to all the single parents that are out there. I know there's a lot of single parents that are doing their best, trying to do both sides of this spectrum, the man and the woman's side, and it's difficult. And God designed us, he designed marriage, he designed family that way, and put a man and a woman together forever, raising kids, not until, you know, until we don't like each other anymore, but until death do us part. And so that's sort of the way God, that isn't sort of, that's the way God put things together. I remember, it's interesting, as a kid growing up, the differences between moms and dads really came out. My mom had a lot of rules, and we could never follow all those rules. Y'all follow all your parents' rules and all your mom's rules? Yeah, we could never follow them. And we were constantly in trouble, you know, at home, and I was just a model child, you know, so I don't know what the issue was. They're not alive anymore, so they can't refute that. But we would always be getting ourselves into trouble, and it's interesting because we could get away with a lot with my mom, and she would get mad at us, and she would yell at us, and she'd give us a spanking. Oh, that hurt. But we never broke the rules when guess who came home? Not when Dad came home. When Dad came home, oh boy, you know, everything changed. And I learned early on, one day I was in our family room, and we had an opening into the kitchen, and I witnessed my mom and my older brother getting into it at the moment that my dad walked in the door. And I remember my dad walking in the door, he didn't take him but 5 seconds to hear what was going on. He grabbed my brother. We had a paddle. It used to be one paddle. And he grabbed the paddle, grabbed my brother, and said, "You will not talk to my wife that way." Ping! He broke the paddle on my brother's behind. And I'm sitting there like, never diss mom when dad's around. You know, that was in my little brain. And it's interesting because God created us differently as husbands and wives, as moms and dads. Now, you might think that it's interesting. Well, what we're going to talk about this morning is, I think, a really good sort of dad type of thought. It's probably the most challenging thought. We've been talking about loving like Jesus loved. So love like Jesus. And we've been looking at Jesus and his lifestyle and how he loved people. And today is probably the toughest one of the whole set so far. And what we're going to talk about this morning is being bold for the truth. Jesus never backed off of the truth. Without boldness, we cannot love like Jesus, because we will not have the backbone to do what's right when what is right is needed. Now, I'm going to jump right into the deep end this morning, and I'm going to jump in with a pretty deep question. And I want you to know, long before the current circumstances of our culture was erupting before us in media, I already was laying out the sermons, and this was one of them. So, oh, Pastor John, you know, watch the news, and now he's, woo. No, this was actually all in the plan before all the riots started. But I want to jump into the deep end by asking you just a couple of questions to get your mind racing a little bit this morning. What would you do if you saw something that was not right? What would you do? When you see injustice, when you see someone is not being treated correctly, when someone is doing harm to themselves or others, do you step in? Do you walk the other way? Do you turn a blind eye? Do you just get out your cell phone and begin to take pictures of what's going on? Do you justify the behavior on either side? Do you address it? Do you love other people enough to stand up for what is right, even if standing up for what is right is not popular or is not liked by the rest of society? So these concepts, I was already putting all this together before we got into this whole race riot thing and all the stuff that happened in Minneapolis with the cops on either side of the fence that y'all fall on. So I want us to go into this a little bit this morning if we are going to love like Jesus, we need to have a bold commitment to the truth. And we need to think about this. Will we stand up when we see some injustice, when we see something that is not right? Will we get involved, or we will excuse it away that they must deserved it and I don't understand, or we don't know the whole story and there's more to the story than what's really being told? Will we turn a blind eye to things? Will we get involved in things that may not seem like it's any of our business? You know, the cops know what they're doing and I don't, so I'm just going to stay out of it. Or would we speak up? Would we try to stop it? Would we get ourselves involved? So far in our series, Love Like Jesus, we've had some challenging concepts, but this is the toughest one. This is the hardest one. Because if we're going to love like Jesus, it means that we must have a bold commitment to the truth. We must be having a kind of tough love that's inside of us. And here's the concept, the key concept I want you to hear this morning. To love like Jesus requires a bold commitment to the truth, regardless of its popularity or its reflection on me. If we're going to love like Jesus, we must have a bold commitment to the truth, regardless of its reflection or its impact on me. I want to spend just a couple minutes this morning looking at the scriptures. We've been doing that. We've been going into Jesus and his life and seeing from him and how he lived these principles out and just making a couple simple applications right out of his life. Before we go there, Father, I want to come to you. You are my dad. And Father, you are the one that I want to model my life after. And it may be difficult at times, and it frankly may not be popular at times. But I pray that you will indwell your spirit inside of me and dwell your spirit inside of all of us, that we will love like you loved, Jesus. And that we will have a bold commitment for the truth, which means we have to be people of integrity, people who are congruent with our inside all the way to our outside. And so I pray you'll speak to us this morning, you'll lead and you'll guide us. And you'll show us your truths, Jesus, from your life. Holy Spirit, come and be our teacher, I pray this morning. Amen. If we're going to learn how Jesus loved, we have to go back to the book. We have to go back to the Bible and take a look at what happened in Jesus' life. And so I want to take you to a couple stories from Jesus' life. The first story that I want to take you to actually happened right at the top of his ministry, his public ministry. It's out of John chapter 2, and it's verses 13 through 14. If you have a Bible or you have your Bible app, I'd encourage you to open it up and flip over to it, John chapter 2. We're going to pick up with 13, and I'll read this story to you, and then if I can see it. Woo! That's part of the fun of getting old, ain't it? Then we're going to break it down a little bit. When the angels had left them and gone into heaven... I'm in Luke. Sorry. Yeah, that's not what my Bible says. Hang on, sorry about that. It's a good passage of Christmas there, I see. Okay, John chapter 2. There we go. Wedding banquet. All right, now we're right after that. Verse 13. Yeah, let's start with verse 12. After this, he went down to Capernaum with his mother and his brothers and his disciples. There they stayed for a few days. Okay, verse 13. When it was almost time for the Jewish Passover, Jesus went up to Jerusalem. In the temple courts, he found men selling cattle and sheep and doves and others sitting at tables exchanging money. So he made a whip out of cords and drove them all from the temple area, both sheep and cattle. He scattered the coins of the money changers. He scattered the coins of the money changers. Somebody doesn't let go of their money. That's funny. All right. And overthrew their tables. Ooh, you guys gonna overthrow a table? All right. Get these out of here. How dare you turn my father's house into a market? His disciples remembered that it is written, "Zeal for your house will consume me." And then the Jews demanded of him, "What miraculous sign can you show us to prove your authority to do all this?" And Jesus answered him, "Destroy this temple, and I will raise it again in 3 days." The Jews replied, "It has taken us 46 years to build this temple, and you're going to raise it in 3 days?" But the temple he had spoken of was his body. After he was raised from the dead, his disciples recalled what he had said. Then they believed the scriptures and the words that Jesus had spoken. Now, while he was in Jerusalem at the Passover feast, many people saw the miraculous signs he was doing and believed in his name. But Jesus would not entrust himself to them, for he knew all men. He did not need man's testimony about man, for he knew what was in a man. Let me reread that last verse. He did not need man's testimony. He did not need to be popular. He did not care what people thought of him, for he knew what was in a man. Well, many of you have probably heard that story before. And in this picture, it seems like Jesus is angry. So it doesn't seem like a story that you would share that displays Jesus' love. And it's not a story where you think, well, how can we see love in this passage? But there is a huge truth of love, especially, you got it, especially if you understand what's going on in the background here. And this is fascinating. As many as 4 million Jewish people would travel to Jerusalem during the Passover every year. They would come from Syria, from Galilee, from all over the Roman Empire, down in Egypt, anywhere Jews were, they would come back to Jerusalem. It was the climax of the Jews' year. So sort of like our Christmas, that was Passover. It was the pinnacle holiday of the year. Not only that, but if you were a devout Jew, you had to go back. Because if you didn't go back to Jerusalem to celebrate the Passover, you were actually breaking some of the Jewish rites. And so you could actually get kicked out of God's family, if you will, if you did not make this pilgrimage to go back to Jerusalem. So as Jesus had done since he was a little kid every spring, he went down to Jerusalem to visit the temple. But this Passover wasn't like any other for Jesus. Now, it's sort of interesting, down at the Jewish temple and in Jerusalem, the Jews do not believe, well, they don't believe in idolatry. So idolatry, the rule of idolatry, even went to the point of coins. Anybody have real money? I don't know if this has, let's take a look at this. Nah, it doesn't. Anybody has some real money? Oh, let's go to the big people. Let's take their money. Any big people have some real money? Okay, here's some. Nice. Got more? Okay, what's on the front? This is a $20 bill. What's on the front? Anybody know what's on the front of a $20 bill? If you don't know what's on the front of a $20 bill, give me your 20 and I'll tell you. Trying, okay? Andrew Jackson's on the front. This would be considered by Jews idolatrous because they are worshiping the image of a man being on their money. Now, do you know where we get the idea of putting people's faces on money? The Roman Empire. Caesar. In fact, at another point in Jesus' ministry, when he was asked about taxes, Jesus said, "Hey, give to Caesar what's Caesar's. His face is on the money. Give it to him. It's his money." And so by the Jewish standard, this is considered idolatry. Here you go. I'll be nice. I'm giving it back. Okay. So what would happen is in Jerusalem, that money would be considered illegal by the Jews, if you will, because it had a man's face on it. And so any business that you did in Jerusalem, your money, which everybody else outside of Jerusalem did not use Jewish money. Only in Jerusalem did they use Jewish money. So if you're from Caesarea, if you're from Syria, if you're from Egypt, if you're from the Galilee region, if you're anywhere outside of Jerusalem, you would be using Roman currency. And it would have, you know, Caesar's picture on it. It'd have a man's picture. So your money was no good in Jerusalem. And so guess what some wise business crafty men devised? An exchange. And an exchange rate. And so in the temple around there, because that's where people would be focused on, is coming to the temple. And when they went to the temple, they would have to buy goods for the temple to make offerings and whatnot. They would also have to pay sacrifice, or they'd also give their temple tax, so they'd have to pay their Jewish taxes, and their Roman money wouldn't be good for that. And so at the temple, there was men who would exchange your currency for the Jewish currency, for the denarii or for the talent or whatever the money at the time was in, that the Jews were using, and they would exchange money. Now, they would do that at a cost. It wasn't a free exchange. So you have a 20, and I'll give you 20 denarii. I'll give you 20, you know, of our Jewish Jerusalem temple money. You know, we'll exchange it even for... No. You give me your 20 in Roman money, and I'll give you a 5 in Jewish money. And I'll keep 15 for the exchange rate. And they were ripping people off. And what's interesting is the high priest actually sanctioned this, and this was all happening around the courts. And so here you had all these out-of-towners coming in, and they were having to pay exuberant exchange rates in order to fulfill their Jewish vows and their Jewish commitments, to the point that it actually, just to pay the Jewish tax, caused some people to sell their homes, sell their livestock, to go into debt, to be able to afford the exchange rate. So that was going on. Now, what's up with the animals? If you went down to Jerusalem, I'm so glad we don't practice this anymore, but if you went down to Jerusalem, they practiced the rites of sacrifice. And so if your family had done some things wrong throughout the year, you would have to bring a lamb or a dove or certain different kinds of sacrifices into the temple, and there they would kill that sacrifice. It would atone for those sins, and you would be right with God and right with your fellow Jewish people. Well, if you're coming from Galilee and you're already not a very wealthy person, chances are you're not going to come down with a whole bunch of livestock because you're just trying to get your kids there. Any of you ever go on vacation with your kids? It's just a feat to get your kids there, okay? Let alone the livestock and the farm. And so these people would make their way down, and then they would have to buy animals to be able to go in and make these sacrifices. And once again, the wise business people, in cahoots with the priests, charged exuberant amounts for these animals. And a lot of times, these animals were not the greatest in the healthy. They weren't great animals. They were sort of the seconds, you know. The farmers there, they kept the really good stuff and made their own sacrifice. And these are sort of the seconds and thirds. And they then would pass these off to the out-of-towners that would come in. And now here is the kicker. This one just gets me. They would buy this animal at an exuberant price. So if lambs cost $10, we're going to charge you $20 because you sucker can't bring one with you. And so I buy this lamb for $20. I take it in to have it sacrificed for our family so we can be right with God and be at peace with the Jewish community. And the priest would then look over this lamb and find the smallest thing wrong with it and deem it unclean. You know what that meant? You couldn't go out and exchange it because now it's been deemed unclean. So the guy you bought it from is not going to take it back and give you a better one. Nope, it's unclean. You just got to throw that one away. And you would have to go and buy another lamb. And this could go on for cycles. You see how they'd start to get poor? This was going on. This was happening every year, every day around the temple. And this is what Jesus came into the temple and saw and knew was going on. Now, how many of you ever seen abuse of that nature happen? It's happening. And everybody's saying and thinking, I wish somebody would do something. You ever wonder that? I wish somebody would speak up. I wish somebody would do something. Well, Jesus' blood began to boil, and he decided it's time to do something, and I'm going to do it. And it's interesting. This story happens twice in Jesus' ministry, at the start and at the end. I read the story from the start of the ministry. All he has done is turned water into wine. That's the only miracle he's done. He isn't known by people. There isn't all the disciples following him at this point. He is sort of a lone ranger. Nobody knows. You know, he's not declared himself, you know, God's son. None of that has happened at this point. He is just a carpenter from Galilee coming down to do the rites of the Passover. And all of a sudden, he goes into the temple. His blood begins to boil. He gets mad. He walks over to the first money changer, puts his hands on that table, and he flips the table over. Coins going everywhere. Roman coins. coins and the Jerusalem coins flying everywhere. And I can imagine that guy freaking out. This has never happened. And he's thinking, where's all my money? You know, and Jesus goes over next to him, flips the next table over. Eventually, he makes a cord out of whips and he begins slapping it at the donkeys and begins slapping it at the lambs and the doves. And they all start flying away and the lambs begin taking off across the temple courts. And everything is in chaos. And Jesus says, how dare you make my Father's house a marketplace? And another translation says, a den of thieves and robbers. And I am sure there were plenty of people. Now, what's interesting, the temple is so big that the priest didn't even hear what was going on because this is in the outer courts. But I got a feeling all those peasants and all those poor people and all those travelers that were waiting in these long lines for the money to be exchanged, all those people were sitting there like, wow, somebody finally did something. Wow. It's interesting because Jesus is normally very peaceful, very loving, and so this anger, this rage, this boldness is not something we oftentimes associate with Jesus. We associate with him being, you know, the peaceful shepherd, you know, the loving guy that just feels so warm and fuzzy. Not always. When injustice happened, Jesus also had a streak where he could be unbelievably bold. And this racket sent his blood boiling. This injustice was more than he could handle. And so he flew, I believe, in a controlled rage, but flew into a rage because this was wrong. Having established that Jesus was bold, I now have to establish another truth with you, a partnering truth. Jesus was not just bold, but he was bold for or with the truth. There are plenty of examples in the Old Testament that you can go to where you will see guys who were bold, but they were not bold for the truth. They were bold for Asherah, for foreign gods. They were bold for the foreign enemies sometimes. Right now in our Tuesday night study, we're reading through 1 Samuel, and these people were bold because they wanted a king. And Samuel said, you don't really want a king. Yes, we want a king. And they were bold. They wanted that king. So we see plenty of times in the Bible where we see people are bold, but they're not bold for the truth. In the New Testament, we have a really, I always thought this was a cool passage of scripture. This is just to me, this is a teenage boy thing, okay? So it happens in Acts chapter 12. And it's the story of King Herod. King Herod had just put to death James, the brother of John. Remember James and John? Well, James just got put to death. He just put Peter in prison, and all these guys, this all happened because they refused to stop speaking about Jesus. Peter had just been freed by an angel, and King Herod is so mad about this that those Roman guards let this guy go. He actually kills the Roman guards because it's their fault Peter got freed. And then King Herod goes before the people dressed in his royal robes, and he makes this unbelievable speech, and everybody's like, ooh, ah, Herod. Let me read the passage to you. Acts chapter 12. On the appointed day, Herod, wearing his royal robes, sat on his throne and delivered a public address to the people, and they shouted, this is the voice of a god, not of man. Immediately, because Herod did not give praise to God, an angel of the Lord struck him down, and he was eaten by worms and died. Lucas, you think that's cool? I just think that's cool. He got eaten by worms. Then he died. He didn't die, then get eaten by worms, which is the natural decomposition. He got struck down, eaten by worms, and died. That just, isn't that gooey, you know? And this all happens in front of everybody. Why? Because Herod was bold, but not bold for God. Not bold for truth. And God takes that seriously. God took it seriously and struck him down. So being bold is only half the story. We're called to be bold for the truth. Jesus was not just bold for the sake of being bold. In fact, as I studied the life of Jesus, he does not come across as usually a bold guy. He seems to be a fairly meek and quiet-spoken guy, except when he needs to speak out.
on the surface, he comes across as a nice guy. But then we see these passages every now and then that pop up where he is unbelievably bold for the truth. Let me share another quick two stories. They're the same story, but there's two halves to this story. So I need you to pay attention for the whole story. And this comes out of John chapter 8. I'm just going to tell you the story. The teachers of the law and the Pharisees, the religious leaders, they're always trying to get Jesus. So they're trying to trap Jesus. And so they find this poor lady who is caught in adultery. And you can ask your parents about what all that means. But they catch this lady in adultery and they throw her before Jesus. And they have the perfect trap set. Because you see, in Jewish culture, in Jewish law, if a person is caught in adultery, they have broken one of the fundamental Ten Commandments. So not one of the small little of the thousand commands. It's one of the fundamental commands. And they are called to stone that person to death. Okay, so that's the punishment for being caught in adultery. Very serious issue. Now the problem is, in Roman culture, and Rome runs the show right now, in Rome, they're not allowed to stone anybody. They're not allowed to put anybody to death unless they're convicted in a Roman court. So only in a Roman court can Rome dictate that a person be put to death. Crucifixion, stoning, whatever. That's why you see it in the end of Jesus' life, before he gets crucified, he had to go to a Roman court before the Jews could crucify him on a cross. So it was Rome that had to do this. So they throw this lady before Jesus, and they say, our law dictates that this lady needs to be stoned to death. Jesus, what do you say? And it was a perfect trap. Because if Jesus looks at this lady and says that, well, we can't stone her and she should be set free, they're like, oh, then you're not a true Jew. You don't believe in God. You can't be the Messiah. And they would nix him. It would discredit him before the Jews. Yet, if he said, well, we should stone her, she was caught in adultery, then Rome's going to step in. They're going to see Jesus as a dissenter breaking Roman law and encouraging people to break Roman law. And Jesus is going to get hauled off in handcuffs and thrown in prison because now he's a dissenter against Rome. And Rome takes that very seriously, especially in the Jewish communities, because they had a lot of problems with this. And so it was the perfect trap that they were trying to catch Jesus in. And so it's sort of interesting what happens here. The lady's standing before Jesus, and the scriptures say that Jesus bends down and begins to write in the sand. Now, some preachers go off on what he wrote. Who cares? I think it had nothing to do with what he wrote. I think what Jesus was doing was he was showing this lady, by the way, she was probably about half clothed when she was thrown into the public eye like this, because they caught her in the act of adultery. And I think Jesus was showing this lady respect by bowing his eyes, not looking at her, and writing in the sand. And then Jesus says the most remarkable thing. He says, you know what? Basically, you're right. She deserves to be stoned. But I tell you what, the person who has no sin, why don't you just be the one to throw the first stone? How about that? If you're sinless, you throw the stone. We'll all follow. Then it says Jesus looked up. Asked the ladies. So now he's looking in the ladies' eyes. Where did all your accusers go? And she's looking around. The only people left now are maybe the disciples, Jesus, and the woman. Not a whole lot left in the crowd because everybody just scattered. And the lady says they've all left. Now there's two parts here. The story goes on. Don't leave me yet, but I want to jump into this first part. Jesus boldly stood for the truth. And in this situation, this lady was only a pawn being used. Do you think they cared about this lady? Not one iota. She was just a toy for them to use in order to try and trap Jesus, which was their goal. So she had absolutely no value to these people. No value. It was an injustice, like an unbelievable injustice. Could you imagine somebody grabbing you in the midst of your sin and then throwing you into the public square and then crying out to everybody there, look what they did! Look what Lauren did! Could you imagine that? They didn't care one bit about her. And yet Jesus respected her enough to write in the sand and then stand up for her. A person nobody else really cared about, and a person that, why should we? By the way, do you remember last couple weeks I talked about the tax collectors? That when nobody liked those guys, and yet Jesus even stood up for the hated tax collectors? Jesus had a bold stance for truth of loving people. But the story goes on. So he looks up at the lady and says, okay, where did your accusers go? And they all left. And now I want you to catch this. Jesus stands for the truth. Did this lady do wrong? Yes or no? Thumbs up or thumbs down? Give me your thumbs up or thumbs down. Did she do something wrong? I'm not seeing a whole lot of this side. Okay, next question. Did this lady by their law deserve to be stoned? Thumbs up, thumbs down. Thumbs up, thumbs down. What do you think? Thumbs up. She deserved what they were asking to have happen. She deserved it. She made the choice. She did wrong. She deserved that. And you know what's fascinating? Jesus never looks a blind eye to what she deserved. Never did. Never said, oh, what you did, honey, is not that big of a deal. We can look the other way. You know, it's just a little adultery. We can let that go. He looked up at her and said, where do your accusers go? She said, they all left. And who is, by the way, in that crowd, the only person who could have thrown the stone? Jesus. And he said, you know what? I won't throw the stone. I'll forgive you. But then the story goes on one more little piece. And we cannot miss this next little piece. Looking at this lady, he doesn't deny the truth, doesn't deny what she's doing is wrong, but he says, okay, I don't condemn you, but you need to go leave your life of sin. You need to stop doing what you're doing. It's going to harm you. It's going to lead you to a mess. You deserve to be stoned for what you did. You know it. I know it. The disciples know it. They knew it. Everybody knows it. I'm going to forgive you of that, but he didn't deny the truth. I'm going to forgive you for what you did, but now you need to stop. You need to go leave your life of sin. Jesus boldly stood for the truth. So the next natural question then for us to ask is, why don't we live like Jesus? Why do we have such a hard time being bold truth tellers? If we peel back all the layers and get to the core answer, we would probably have to admit that we don't want to be bold for the truth because we are fearful. And in a specific word, we are fearful of rejection. I don't want to tell the truth because somebody may not like it, and they may not like me. We're afraid of being too emotional or being seen as too emotional or not emotional enough. As too assertive or not assertive enough, as too aggressive or not aggressive enough, or too whatever and whatever enough. We're afraid of being alienated. We're afraid of losing approval and acceptance by other people. And so rather than standing for the truth, we sort of waver and we waffle around a little bit because we're afraid of what other people may think of us. The result is that we learn early on in our lives to wear masks. Because it's so much simpler to wear a mask than to boldly stand for the truth. It's so much easier just to put on a mask. We become, as Abraham Maslow called it, jellyfish in armor. By pretending to be fine when you're not, by acting indifferent when something truly irks us, and by clamming up when we really have something to say, ultimately we wear masks when we accept pluralistic ignorance, end of quote. We vacillate between our impulse to be well-liked and well-known and yet be true to ourselves. So we hide ourselves. We want to be known. You know, I run into people and they're like, well, nobody likes me and nobody knows me and I have no friends. And yet they don't want anybody to know who they are. And we can't live in both worlds. We have to be true. We have to be true to ourselves. And we end up in this paradox where I want to be known and I want to be liked and I want people to accept me for who I am, yet I won't tell you the truth about who I am because you may not like me and you may not like what you find and what you see. And so we live guarded lives. And in that state, you can never love like Jesus. And here's why. You're too concerned about what people think of you than what they think of your Jesus. You're more concerned about what they think of you than them, than the person themselves. In fact, Jesus put his finger right on this squarely. He called us to be truth tellers. I love the way the Message Bible translates this. Luke chapter 6, verse 26, and here's the way the Message translates it. Therefore, there's trouble ahead of you when you live only for the approval of others, saying what flatters them, doing what indulges them. Popularity contests are not truth contests. Look how many scoundrel preachers were approved by your ancestors. Your task is to be true, not popular. I love the way Luke 6 says it out of the Message. Moms and dads, your task is to be true, not popular with your kids. I'll be up front with you. If you're going to stand for truth with your kids are not always going to like you. Amen, moms and dads?
Amen.
It's the way it's going to be. It's not a popularity contest with your kids. I work with our incoming pastors in our district. There's around 50 of them, Hispanic pastors, English-speaking pastors. They're all working to become pastors and get ordained. And one of the things I try to tell them over and over again, if you're becoming a pastor and you think this is a popularity contest, you better change your profession, because being a pastor is not popular, and more so in our current culture. If you think this is a popularity contest, whew, you're in the wrong job. And this is true for all of us. Your task is to be true, not popular. All this builds up to another word that I want to share with you this morning, and the word is simply integrity. Integrity. If you look up the word integrity, it simply means same throughout. So in other words, if you bite into a candy bar, the first bite of the candy bar, if it has integrity, the last bite will taste just like the first bite. It is same throughout. Now, Michelle and I obviously are working on moving out here to Valley City, and we're changing houses. And so one of the phrases that keeps, I think it's actually from Duck Dynasty is where I picked this up, but I just think it's hilarious. You can put makeup on a pig, but it's still a pig. Anybody ever heard that? And people will use that in reference to houses. You can make up the house and make it look really good, but underneath it might still be a pig. And it's so funny, because my Saturday is my day off, and my Saturday consists of sitting down and watching home improvement shows for about an hour or 2 hours. And so I've ran out of all the This Old House. That's my favorite. Anybody else, This Old House? Love This Old House. Right now they're finished with their current house, and so we're in between seasons. And so now I'm watching some Mike Holmes from Canada. He's a Canadian, eh? And he goes through houses, and Mike Holmes makes it right. And so yesterday, I'm not kidding you, I had this all done, and I'm sitting here watching this show, and they go into a house, and they're looking at, they had already done this, and they went back and redid this one because it was so popular. And basically, this house looked beautiful. It was 5 years old. At this point, it was 7 years old. The couple bought it at 5 years old, and at 7 years they called Mike Holmes in because they're having water problems, and it's a beautiful looking house. It's gorgeous. And Mike Holmes starts going through the house, and the house, while it had top-notch siding and windows and clapboard and had everything done, had good products on it, it was not put together right. Every window in the house was leaking. The seams between the siding were leaking, and literally the inside of the house was rotting away, but the outside looked great. And he said it over and over, you can put lipstick on a house, but it doesn't mean it's a good house. I'm like, you gotta be kidding me. Really? Really? Right now? This is awesome. And they start peeling away the lipstick, and literally the whole house is rotting from the inside out, because water had gotten in and molding. Now, luckily, that house, it was only a few of the structural pieces, but a lot of the clapboard, the backing behind the siding was destroyed. You see, you can clean up the outside, but if the inside isn't right, the whole cards are going to topple. The whole thing is going to fall in on itself. As Christ followers, we are called to have integrity. And what that means is that we are the same throughout. In other words, what we see of you on a Sunday morning is the same that we would see of you on a Friday night or a Wednesday afternoon. Integrity means that what we see of you in public is the same person that you are in private, like in front of your computer screen when no one else is looking. You're the same throughout. Everything we've been talking about this morning leads up to this huge truth. When we lack integrity, we cannot love like Jesus. And here's why. When my inside doesn't match my outside, I become consumed worrying about how others perceive me so that they might never see the true me. They may never see what's on the inside. I become consumed with image control. I become consumed with making a good impression. I become consumed with popularity, making sure I live in the right house and have the right car and wear the right clothes. I become consumed with the possibility that if anybody ever saw the real me, they may not like me. I become consumed with my persona and what others see of me. I become consumed controlling the narrative so that I can make myself look good. And so I put on and constantly wear a mask. Does that sound remotely familiar to our society today? We wear a mask because we don't want to see what's really going on under the hood. We want all from politicians to everyday users, Facebook people, we try to put our best foot forward so people see all the cool things we're doing. But we never get real on Facebook. You ever try and get real on Facebook? Anybody? And did you lose friends? Yeah. Here's a situation. When what you do and what you say does not match the person you are on the inside, when truth is not being revealed to others, you develop an incongruent or fragmented self. And your outside doesn't match what's going on in your inside. You become consumed not by how other people are doing, but how am I doing in your eyes? That's what happens. I become so consumed worrying about what you think of me, I no longer care about you. I'm only concerned what you think of me. And so we back off the truth, even though the truth may be the very thing that needs to be spoken, the very thing that needs to be uncovered. I won't share that because I don't want you to not to like me, even though your life may fall apart and I could stop that, but I'm not going to share that. Because you may not like me. I told you at the top of this thing, this is probably the toughest love like Jesus truth that we've faced so far. To boldly stand for the truth is a radical call to be honest with ourselves and be honest with other people. For when I have integrity, when I am the same throughout, then I can love like Jesus, not worrying about what you think of me. Because I'm the same throughout. What you see here is what you get. I'll just be open and honest with you. This, when I was putting all this together, it hit me so strong. I called my accountability partner. And I have somebody that I'm accountable to that I sit down with and we talk back and forth. We're both accountable to each other. And I told him this week, we sat at Four Keys. We went to Four Keys. Ooh, love that place. So we went to Four Keys. We sit in there and I said, okay, I need you to hold me accountable on this. And every week, I want you to ask me, John, have you been truthful with everybody in your life? And I told him exactly what I was sharing. I said, I need to be accountable on that. Because it's even hard. It's hard for me. I don't want to shade or back off. Now, it's telling the truth in love, by the way. Don't go out and beat people up like, oh, Rich, you're a bad, bad person. You know, that's not okay. It's telling the truth in love. But I asked him, hold me accountable that I will be a truthful person. And every week just ask me, John, have you been truthful with everybody you've been with? We cannot love if we are not boldly standing for the truth. Because we're more concerned, when we don't, we're more concerned about what you think of me than you. So with each of these thoughts, with each of these concepts I've been teaching you, I've just been giving you some simple ways that we can move into this. So I have three quick, very simple ways that we can move into this. You can write these down if you want. Number one, be honest about who you are. If you want to move into this direction, that's the first one. Be honest about who you are. Don't back off. Have you ever had a really bad Sunday morning? I mean, a knockdown, drag-out fight with your kids, you know? And then I always call it the miracle of the doors. When you hit the doors on Sunday morning, all of a sudden all the problems are gone and you walk in like everything's fine. and then somebody says, how are you doing? Oh, I'm doing fine. And the whole time you're thinking, I can't wait till we get out of here because my kids are going to get it. Anybody? It's not. That's not congruent. Are you being honest? Now, I'm not saying you need to spill all your guts, you know, and have this whole thing just laid out. But you know what? Wouldn't it be cool to be a part of a community where somebody says, how are you doing? And you just had a knockdown drag out with your husband or your wife, and you're able to say, right now, I'm not doing so good, but I'm hoping as I come to worship, I can start doing better. Because the morning so far hasn't been so good. Isn't that a lot more honest? You don't have to get in the nitty-gritty. So the first thing I want to tell you is be honest about who you are. Be honest about what's going on in your life. You don't need to spill your guts on everything, but just be honest. Have you ever been mum because you didn't want to rock the ship? Some of you guys are going to have Father's Day dinners today. And have you ever been mum, you know, because you just didn't want to rock the ship at all, so you just... And you had to eat it because nobody, you're thinking nobody's going to like what you had to say? That's not congruent. That's not honest. Now, you need to be peaceful, too, in how you approach this. Don't just throw it out there and start a war, okay? But be honest about who you are. Number two, and here's the only way you can do number one. Find your personal identity in Jesus Christ and not in the eyes of your brother or your sister. If you cannot find your identity in Jesus Christ, you will always be trapped by the popularity contest and what other people think. You first have to find your identity in Jesus. And if you have not done that, if you have not figured out how to move into a relationship with Jesus to the point that you can get your identity from Him, you're always going to be entrapped and enslaved by the identity crisis thing, trying to please somebody and make somebody else happy, your husband, your wife, your employer, whoever. Find your personal identity in Jesus Christ. And then number three, come to the place to practice genuinely laying down your value so that you can take up the value of another. When you understand that your value and how much Jesus loves you, do you realize He loved you enough to die for you? He loved the tax collectors. He loved the lady in adultery. If He loved people like that, He can probably love you. And when we find our identity in Jesus Christ, then I can come to the place of raising up your value over my value. I don't need to be validated by you to be okay. And so now I can really care about you. How are you doing? What's going on in your life? And at that point, that's when we can really begin to love like Jesus. And so here's my challenge. We're going to give you a simple challenge to help you move down this road. Five times this week, I would like you to ask five different people, honestly, how are you doing? And don't tell them how you're doing. Don't use it as a platform to, well, let me tell you what's going on in my life. Genuinely concern yourself with the life of another person. Ask them, how are you doing? Listen, put on, as my mom used to say, John, put on your listening ears. Put on your listening ears and really listen to how they are doing. And care about it. Care about what they're saying. Care about what they're sharing. And I'd like to challenge you to try that with five people. It might be one of your own kids. They may be, you know, you may be having to scrape them off the walls because who knows what's going on. And you just sit them down and say, you know, so-and-so, how are you doing? What's going on? And don't try and correct them. Don't try and fix the problems. Just, that's another thing. Don't try and fix the problems. Just listen, how are you doing it? If you could do that with five people this week, it's going to move you down this road quite quickly. We are trying our best to love like Jesus. It's our goal. It's our hope. And until we become people of integrity, until we find our value in Christ, we will never be able to lay down ourselves enough to really lift other people up and to love them as Jesus would love them. So that's my challenge for you, to love like Jesus, to care more about others than you care about yourself. Father, I pray that you will help us be able to accomplish this. And I pray for an extraordinary amount of grace and courage and wisdom for our dads. I think this is a wonderful Dad's Day sermon. This is something that dads tend to go towards more than, I think, moms. So, Father, help us as dads to be bold about the truth with our own children, be it young or be it even older. And help us to do so in love. Jesus, thank you for living these principles out before us and modeling them for us. That whole scene of that lady caught in adultery blows me away. And that Jesus, you loved her so much when nobody else did, and you even confronted her with her wrong. Wow. May we emulate that in our lives. Give us the courage to do it this week, to put it into practice, to give it a whirl, to try it out. And may we truly love like you, Jesus, in all of our lives. Amen.